Hey guys, welcome to episode 2 of the Myths That Make Us podcast. Today I have on friend, coworker, and the director of human optimization, Kyle Kingsbury. We may or may not have been microdosing on LSD, and I honestly don't remember what we talked about, but I remember it being emotionally... Actually, no, it's coming back to me right now as I start to say that I don't remember it. We get into his story, and he talks about a really powerful moment early in his life where he thought about killing himself, and he actually started to commit to it. And he had a moment that, you know, I've read about in psychology books and history books that some of, you know, the greats have talked about where they want to give up on their lives, and then they hear a voice that says, you know, it changes, the specifics change, but the theme is the same, and it's that your life is not your life to take. Anyways, we get into his myth, and it gets personal, and it gets deep, and it gets beautiful, and I really enjoyed this conversation, and I think that you guys will as well. And as I said on the first podcast, as I do more podcasts, this thing will come together more and more and become more honed. It's very raw at the beginning, and I appreciate you. I love you guys, and I think you guys are going to really enjoy this podcast. Kyle, welcome to the Myths That Make Us podcast. And basically, to give you an idea of what I'm doing, and also this is going to be one of the first episodes, so giving people a sense of what's going on here, is everyone has a story about who they think they are. And everyone has a story about what they think life is. And all of our stories are not unique. There are myths from ancient times that we find one of them at some point when we're children. And it's either that was already our myth and we found it and it resonates with us, or we found it as a young person, we picked it. But I don't know the truth there, but we pick a myth
chicken
early.
Chicken and the egg.
Right. And then we start to live that shit. And the myths have endings. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to help people recognize what story they're inside of so they can see the ending. And then they can choose, do I want this story or do I want a different myth? So, the goal here is going to be to try to get you to articulate your myth. And I've got some interesting questions that I think will be fun.
Ha! Yes!
All right. And then we'll just riff and see where it goes. But if I met you somewhere where you were in your peak truthful state, and so for most people, I say like if I met you at like a bar or like a party and you had like one or two drinks in you, but that's not your state. Let's say I met you at Burning Man and you weren't completely into the unconscious realms of psychedelics, but you were just about to, and you were in your peak honest state, and I met you for the first time, and I asked you, who are you? What would you say?
Well, I would have to clarify what you mean by the question. Is who am I as my ultimate identity of that, or is it who am I the person Kyle Kingsbury in this body?
Both.
Okay. So Kyle Kingsbury in the body is someone who's trying to figure things out at a rapid pace so I can stay ahead and also so I can continue to learn and grow. And in those experiences, share them with the world. How I would define myself in the greater picture as God embodied in a physical form that chose to be male in this incarnation. In this exact time and place to be born in San Jose, California, in this exact ethos and everything going on around so I could extract the most lessons needed for my soul's learning.
How would your closest lover describe both Kyle the man and Kyle the higher self?
Ooh, that's a tough one now. Kyle the man, I think she would say, is very loving and giving and thoughtful. Also can be a little set in his ways and really push towards whatever thing he's passionate about. So she might say that I have a lot of drive and zest for things. And if there's something new that I really appreciate and love, I want to explore that thing and I'm all in. Right. And there's, from my standpoint, there's no really, I can't really deny that. So there is truth there. But she would say that can be done to a fault.
Right. And then how would she describe your higher self?
You know, she's read a lot of the same books. She's had a lot of the same experiences with psychedelics. I'm not sure she consciously thinks of herself or myself as the embodiment, a droplet of the ocean of God.
Yet. Right.
I don't think that she...
What do you think she thinks?
I'm not sure. Those are the things that I circle back to when life gets tough.
Right.
Whether they're real or not.
Right.
They give me
a
sense of balance.
Yeah.
Right. And I can lean on those things, not as a crutch, but as a sense of security in an unsafe world. And in those experiences, I can open myself back up. Right. So
right.
there's this quote. I don't even know if I can, I'm not going to name drop. Aubrey and I were doing psychedelics with another prominent man who's been on the podcast and is in the top 10 of podcasts. And Whitney came up and read us this quote from Atticus. It's a lonely thing protecting a breakable heart. And we all fucking lost it in the medicine, right? It is. It's a lonely thing protecting a breakable heart.
Yeah.
But I think having that understanding of if I am this soul and I'm going through these things and whatever is being given to me at the moment is for my highest good, for my learning and knowledge. And even though it doesn't seem that way when I'm in the challenge that it's for the best, to realize on some level it is,
yeah.
and that I'll have gratitude for this at some point when I look back, that's been the big one for me. And I think that having that kind of guiding light at the top of the helm there of my understanding of myself makes that possible. I think if there's a lack of that, it's very easy to get stuck in this world.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not see the greater picture.
And to pivot a little bit, how would your closest male friend describe the Kyle and then the higher self?
Aubrey would tell me that the Kyle in body is a rock. The Kyle in body can waver through any storm, has on many levels mastered his emotions. I don't know that necessarily that I would agree with that, but I think that's what Aubrey would say. And then of course the higher self piece, I think he understands that about all of us. That's what makes it so special.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is your first memory? What's the earliest first memory?
I just thought about this the other day. I was on a little microdose of mushrooms. And I think it was because, you know, my son's 3.5 and his buddy Okisi just turned 4. And I'm like, I don't know that I have memories from them, but I think it was somewhere between 3 and 4 that I zipped my penis up for the first time.
Whoa.
And the only reason I know I was that young was because the bathroom I described to my father, he remembered it, but it was in when we were living in Oregon, which means I had to be less than 4. So yeah, I zipped my penis up and it was like the front little meaty portion.
Yeah.
And I was just screaming at the top of my lungs and, you know, I was in the bathroom by myself because I'm old enough to pee by myself. And he comes running and he's like, what's going on? What? And I was like, my baby. And he's like, oh, buddy. And I could see like his anger and scaredness shifted to like complete compassion.
Right.
Like, oh, fuck, buddy. I know exactly what that is. No,
it's okay.
And then we had to take a deep breath and fucking zip down over the goddamn skin.
Oh,
so that was my first memory that I have for sure.
Yeah. So the follow-up question I always ask, but it's going to be self-evident here, is what was the primary emotion of that first memory?
Fear from my father's angry response to love. Like, oh, he sees this. He knows what this is. He's been here before. And then trust. Like, oh, okay. I can relax now.
Yeah.
Daddy's going to help me. It's okay. Everything's okay.
The reverberations of that might make sense as we get through some of these other questions, but I think that that's really interesting. So I'm sure you've seen this with Bear, but there's this weird thing that children do when they're like 3 or 4, where they find a book or a movie, some story, that they just want to be played over and over and over and over. And I think that that is an insight into the myth that we most resonate with. So for you, when you were 3 or 4, or maybe 5 or 6, what was the story, either a book or a movie, that you remember just watching over and over and over? And if you can't think of a specific one, what story, when I ask you, was your favorite as a child, is the first one to pop up?
Either Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs or Where the Wild Things Are.
There's no way that the meatball ones was a movie that you saw when you were a kid.
Movie came out when Bear was a kid.
Okay, yeah.
When I was a kid, yeah. It was just a book.
I mean, for you as a kid. Oh, so the book was something that you had as a kid.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I had that book when I was super young.
Okay, so pick between one of those two, and then we're going to ask you to do something interesting. Imagine that you're going to retell that story in 2 or 3 minutes like you were talking to a smart 10-year-old. So how would you can pick either one of those two stories that you most like, and then try to retell it like you're talking to a smart 10-year-old, and I'll explain the logic.
Well, the one, I mean, even though we both read those both to Bear, the only one that I could actually explain is Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Okay.
Because I still don't get pieces of Where the Wild Things Are.
Okay.
Other than just little shit's got an overactive imagination.
All right, so if you had to try to tell that story, how would you tell that story?
Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Yeah.
So there is a town called Chew and Swallow Falls, and it's off the coast of the Atlantic. And in this town, everyone there has a very particular way about how they eat. Mm-hmm. The weather brings them breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And in the weather reports, they see what it's going to rain that day. It can be anything from hot dogs to cheeseburgers to ice cream cones to whatever. And they always come out with their plates and their forks and their knives to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Mm. Anything that is left over is given to the dogs and then taken away to some type of organic composting center where they can grow flowers from it.
Right.
There's always enough for leftovers. There's never any shortage of food. But then one day, the weather takes a turn for the worse. And it begins to rain really bad storms of smelly broccoli with mayonnaise and rotten things. And just, it gets all bad. Gorgonzola cheese. And the town people have to flee.
Right.
So they set rafts on grilled cheese sandwiches with pizza for sales.
Right.
And they find a new land where people actually have grocery stores. And it's similar to the world we live in. And food does not fall from the sky. Only water and snow fall from the sky.
Yeah.
And they are able to successfully start a new life for themselves in the new place.
So this is really interesting. I've asked this question to probably 85 people. And you're the first person to ever tell the story, not from the perspective of the protagonist, but from the perspective of the entire community. And so I think that that's already a deep insight into what your story is. And it's not a me story. It's a us story. Like, I want to reiterate, like, I've asked this question to like 85 people. Everyone explains it as if they are the protagonist or from the perspective of the protagonist. You didn't talk about the protagonist once. You just talked about the community. And I think that that's really interesting, and that's probably something worth holding on to. What was the first thing that you did as a kid that started to get you a sense of autonomy? So for example, like for me, it was arguing with teachers. That's where I first started to feel power. And
ditto.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the first one for me, but.
And then after that, it was playing sports, specifically basketball. So for you, what was the first thing that you started to do in the world where you started to get a sense of power?
I certainly felt power in kindergarten, talking shit to the other students, and then eventually taking that out on my teachers too.
Yeah.
You know, like I could smart mouth any fucking one of them. Mm-hmm. I could mock them. I could make fun of them. I could take the whole class under my hand at any fucking point. If I wanted it, I had it. Mm-hmm. And being very quick and funny in my own mind just fueled that, right? But that wasn't my first sense of like true autonomy. It was on a bicycle, just riding a bike, feeling like I could go anywhere. Also feeling like the power in my legs and my lungs and tying the breath to my body for the first time, where it just felt like I will never run out of energy. I can do this forever.
Yeah.
And I can go anywhere I fucking want to go. I can leave home if I want to. I can go anywhere.
What age were you?
I want to say like 7's when I first got the Huffy, but 10 is when I really experienced that for the first time.
How would you describe what felt like your identity was in high school? Like, what was the role that you, because
high school is the head jock in high school, same, for sure. When I was a freshman, I got picked on by the seniors. They tried to throw me in trash cans, all that shit. I later became a bully myself. Not physically, nothing I'm fucking proud of, and it feels shitty admitting it, but certainly picked on people. I remember kicking a fan of soda on a bunch of kids playing Magic the Gathering, which is a great story I tell Aubrey because he liked Magic. Could have been fucking Aubrey, right? Just kick a fucking orange fan on these kids fucking and run off laughing. Dick move. So, I mean, the persona in high school was jock, and it wasn't like Trip McNeely or some character you find in a movie. You know, it's me. Like, my expression through sport allowed me to have an outlet from the pain that I had in growing up.
And what was the pain?
Really, you know, there was some physical stuff, but a lot of it had to do with watching my parents fight all the time.
Yeah,
just all the fucking time. And from a very young age, you know, cops being called, shit getting broken. You know, I remember the corded phone, back when we had corded phones, getting ripped out of the wall and thrown through the through a closet door. Like, it was violent, you know, and it wasn't even violence committed in a physical way to one another. It was just violent talk
energetically
and just energetic, and very, everything was based in fear. Like, they had their own fears and they were expressing those fears, and no one knew how to back down from one another. They were just two fucking rams, button heads all the time.
And it's interesting. I read this quote recently from Jung, and it's like, the child is the ultimate lover in the sense that they will feel the energetic tension between the parents, and they, without even recognizing that they're doing it, become a conduit for that energy to come out. And if you look at any teenager who's acting out, quote unquote, it's almost always an energetic spillover of what's happening between the parents. And I remember reading it, and however he said it, I can't remember, but like, it made me start crying like while I was reading. I was just like, fuck, the child is in such a place where their love for the parent is so total that it's like they take on the burden of the energy and try to dispense of it.
Yeah.
That's intense.
Well, we do carry the sins of our fathers,
yeah,
right? And that's something that I picked up on in having my own son, is, you know, the discipline that I did not like having growing up is now in my face with him because I don't discipline him the same way. And yet on that same line of polarity, I never yelled at my dad. I never argued with him. I never said no. I always did what was asked.
Mm.
And Bear does none of that shit.
Yeah,
he'll open hand, slap me in the face.
Yeah.
He fucking is, he's his own little person.
Yeah.
You know, and so seeing like, where do we, you don't want to create somebody who can't listen to others and learn from others and learn from coaches and things like that. There has to be some level of respect for elders and authority. Not ultimate respect, that has to be earned, but some level of baseline, okay, I'll listen.
Yeah.
And so that's the balance, right? But all this stuff came up for me in having him, and not until he was of the age to challenge that part of me, where then I was forced to review the way I was raised.
Yeah, because it's almost like if we don't do the work, our rebellion against our parent makes us the opposite extreme for our children. You know, and like, the way through the middle is to find like, okay, I don't want to be a tyrant, but I also don't want to create someone who it will become a tyrant.
Yeah.
You know, it's weird how it oscillates each generation. Mm-hmm. Like, whatever the energetic extreme is, like whatever the archetype is, it's like it swings in the opposite direction if we rebel against our parent. But then if we stay on that opposite side, we then create the type of container that would allow for the opposite. So like the tyrant and the servant, you know, like to be completely subservient is to create a child that has the expectation that they get to be a king or a tyrant, really,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So the next thing that I like to really dive into is, what was your first dream of what you wanted to be? Like, most people, as children, we kind of have like a flimsy, like, I want to be X, but it's not really thought through about how. But like when we're around 18, 19, or 20, that's when we kind of have our first like ideal future. What was your first dream that of the man that you wanted to be?
Well, it's tough. When I was a little kid, the little kid dream was to be an actor. I loved Arnold. And then, you know, took drama classes and thought like, these are all dorks here. I don't want to be surrounded by people like that in my everyday day-to-day life. Now I actually love actors and I love being able to work with them and things like that, which I have since being a kid. So that kind of notion has been dispelled from my jock self not vibing with them. But I mean, as I got older, it's always changed. You know, when you're 18 and 19, you don't know what the fuck you want to be when you grow up. I certainly didn't. I didn't know what I wanted to learn in college. Like, oh, I'll get a business degree so that way I can be a businessman and make money. And then, no, you're not. You're going to fucking do something else. What do you actually like? Oh, I like psychology. I like sociology. I like understanding the mind. I like figuring people out. I like philosophy. Well, those aren't going to make you money, right? So let's change your major again. And let's just keep doing anything to stay eligible for football is what it ends up becoming. Or did for me at least.
The dream as a teenager to be a professional football player?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
mine
yeah.
was to do
for sure.
basketball, for sure.
Yeah, for sure as a teenager.
So what's really interesting is that most of us, if we get to a place where we're on a podcast at your age, is that you let that dream die. And then you had to create a new dream. Some people, when their adolescent dream dies, stays there for the rest of their life. And they're the people who stay in the hometown, who go out to the bar and talk about high school.
Wear the Letterman jacket.
Right. So their development died.
From Can't Hardly Wait.
Yeah. Like, it's an archetype. Like, they let their soul's development stop. So what I'm curious is, when did that first dream die? And how did you get through the death of that future and then create a new one?
Well, football died at the end of college for me, and it was something I really kept putting off, even though I was sitting the bench. I acknowledged the fact that my senior year would be my last year.
Yeah.
Depression really set in when that ended.
Right. And so that's actually the thing that I want to drive home for people is that's when most of us hit our first episode of depression. And it's because your goal is what gives your life meaning.
And purpose.
Yes. And it's what it tunes your body to give you the emotions that feel good and lets you know where to go, where not to go. But when the dream dies, it's like your internal GPS is broken.
Yeah.
And that's when people fall into a depression.
And what do I have left? I have this shitty degree no one wants in basket weaving from Arizona State, which is a fuck boy college to begin with.
Yeah.
You know, like, don't want to be in sales. Both my parents were in sales. They worked 100% on commission, and that's a fucking super high stress way to
live.
For sure. Not knowing when the next check's going to come. Then, oh shit, we're rich. Let's spend it. And then, oh fuck, now we don't have any savings. You know, like just that fucking roller coaster.
Yeah.
I don't want a piece of that in any way, shape, or form, even if I would be good at it.
Yeah.
And also, I think the greatest sense that I had in my depression then was a sense that I couldn't be loved. And that came on really strong for me in a relationship I was in.
Yeah.
And, you know, I talk about this on Human Optimization Hour, episode 12, where I really take a deep dive through this depression. But the dream shifted, heading back to the dream here. The dream shifted. I still wanted to be an athlete. And I realized that. So at least let me train in mixed martial arts and see where that takes me.
Yeah.
And it very quickly took me into the UFC, where I fought for 6 years.
So would you say, especially in hindsight, that you refused to let the dream die and it turned into a thing and now you've moved on from that adolescent thing? Or do you think that going into the UFC was truly the right move? Like, do you know what I'm saying?
I think it was the right move because I still wanted to be an athlete. I still had a chip on my shoulder. And there were so many lessons I learned from mixed martial arts.
For sure.
Like meditation, breath work, how to quiet my mind, how to be still in the storm. All those things that I still use to this day.
Because there is there's almost no container on the fucking planet. Like basically being naked in front of 100,000 people and it's you against a man who wants to fucking kill you. Like, from like a primal level, like I don't know if there is a testing ground more acute than that on the entire, like probably the only thing close is a presidential debate. Like at the highest level where hundreds of, if they had to do it naked, You know, like that's basically right.
Some sponsors on your ass.
There's something about the UFC that like it's the closest that we can get to like it's the deepest that we can get to a true confrontation with fear.
Yeah, and it forces you like anything that you understand on a mental level, like, oh, I understand how to stay calm. Prove it. I understand how to quiet my mind through breath work. Prove it.
Yeah.
I understand how to remain calm when someone's trying to take my head off. Or if and when I get hit, how to circle back to that level of calm. Do you understand that?
Prove it.
Right?
Yeah.
So I learned so much from fighting that there's no doubt in my mind in hindsight that was the exact fucking thing that I needed. And yeah. If you look at my job today at Onnit, everything I learned in fighting is a testament for to sure. Where I am today. It's everything that I talk about from diet, nutrition, health and wellness, fasting, psychedelics, fucking everything in between. It all came out of fighting. Even yeah. Psychedelics did.
For sure.
Right? So with that, I think if there was a change from dream to dream, how the dream ended for me in fighting so peacefully was because I had been gifted things like ayahuasca and psilocybin mushrooms.
Yeah. The thing that I want to hone in on for people listening is, how did you get first to that through wave of depression where you found the new dream of the UFC? Like, how long did that last? What strategies did you use to try to...
Let's just unpack that in case people don't want to listen to episode 12. I had a good doctor who would give me whatever I wanted. So I had 2 milligram Xanax bars, which are the most potent, 10 milligram Valiums, also had 10 milligram Vicodins.
What age are you here?
22, 23. And, you know, I'd take a lot of the pills. There were 60 pills in a fucking order with like 5 refills. I'd sell a lot off for cocaine and ecstasy. All things that played with my neurochemistry.
Yeah.
And of course, I had no idea about this. So I'm playing with the neurochemistry while still not having unpacked any of my childhood, while still facing not having any drive or purpose left in life.
Yeah.
And decided, you know, and then with that lack of love feeling, decided I was going to kill myself. So I drove to the top of parking lot 7, took every pill that I had left. Thankfully, there weren't that many, and stripped down naked to jump. Now,
whoa,
the guard who saw me go up decided to follow me because it was in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. And he sees me up there with a flashlight, and I'm a big guy who's naked. And he's like, whoa, whoa. And I go like, huh? And before he came up, let me back up. Before he came up, not a spiritual person, had never felt, I've been to church, but I'd never felt God. I'd never felt spoken to in a way. And when I was up there naked, maybe it was the drugs. Mm-hmm. I don't know, because I took them all. But it felt like the deepest sense of calm and peace I had ever felt in my life. And it was, not yet, you know? It's okay, not yet. Like, you'll get to go, but not yet.
Dude, and the thing that you're talking about, like, I knew it was going here and I was getting goosebumps, and it's that there's great stories about when people try to kill themselves. It's the first time that they hear the thing inside of them that's not their ego explicitly talk to them. And it's like, there's something about getting to the point where you're ready to die, where it's the first time the ego is like, oh, I'm not the king. And it's like that creates the window in the psyche for the soul or whatever you want to call it to come through. Like in Robert Greene's book, Mastery, there's this great inventor who like failed at starting a business. His family had no money and he was walking into the ocean to kill himself. And dude, he heard a voice and the voice told him, your life is not yours to throw away. You have gifts to give. Mm. And I think this is a truism of human nature, is if you're about to kill yourself, it doesn't happen all the time, but it seems to be that people, that's the first time in their life that they hear the other. They hear the voice. Like, dude, I ate an edible one time when I was like 19. I drove to Austin to meet a girl. And I did the classic thing where after an hour, I didn't feel it. And then I ate another one and I got too high.
The worst.
Yeah. And I had to drive her friend home. Long story short, I get into a car accident. I'm super high. He's super high. We both have weed and pipes on us and in my bag. And the lady who hit me, but I was so high, I thought it was my fault. She's banging on my window saying, "You hit my baby. You hit my baby." And in my stupid high state, I thought I had murdered her child. I knew the cops were coming, that they were going to find the weed on me, that I was going to go to jail. And I saw my future die. Like, I saw my life unfold about who I could have been, and it just died. And then in that moment, I was like, I'm going to kill myself. And it's the only time in my life I've ever had that thought. And then, like, at moments after that thought, I felt a voice that didn't feel like me say, face the moment, one moment at a time. And it just came with this sense of, like, godlike calm.
Yeah.
You know, and I just put my head up. And long story short, her fault, the toad got paid for, the cops didn't search me. They thought I was crying, I guess, because my eyes were fucking bloodshot. And that's super powerful. And I appreciate you sharing that. And I think it's a testament to why psychedelics work when they work, is that it does the same thing to the ego that contemplating suicide does, is it's like the ego is not the master of the kingdom. And if you subjugate yourself and you kneel before the force inside of you that's beyond the ego, it can talk and it wants to help you.
Yeah. I think it became easier after that point to listen. You know, spent some time in what my mom calls the loony bin after that experience, just getting off the meds, making sure my head was in the correct space before I reentered society. And, you know, I had a psychologist who would talk to me about stuff, and I had a psychiatrist. And it's funny because going into that, I had worked with my first therapist, I was 7 years old, and I was working with him, and I really liked the guy. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, the psychiatrist is the guy who gives you drugs. Didn't like that guy. The psychologist, the guy that would talk to me and help me figure shit out on my own, that's the guy I liked. Mm-hmm. But in this circumstance, it was the opposite.
Yeah,
I felt very quickly that I didn't want to take drugs and I didn't want to take SSRIs. Someone close to me and my family had taken SSRIs and gone on that merry-go-round before. So they offered me lithium, which would, you know, help. I'd been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which is fairly common for people in their early 20s. Also, there could be no other diagnosis if you're doing cocaine, uppers and downers. It's like, come on, bitch. Think about it for a second.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
So with that, got on lithium. And, you know, for a lot of people, lithium gives them a sense of peace and calm in a crazy world. And they get a lot of benefit from it. For me, I felt like a fucking mute. I felt like there was no high, there was no low, and it didn't matter what the fuck happened. It didn't matter what I did each day. It didn't matter if I fucking got out of bed or not. It didn't matter. It didn't matter if I took my meds, right? Everything was fucking just this fucking low bass to monotone shitty life.
Yeah.
And it's probably only like a week, 10 days max when I saw the guy again and I just said, I don't want to take anything.
Yeah.
And he sent me 6 studies on fish oil and the brain and how it helps with neurochemistry and balance. And that was the first time I thought of a supplement. Now I just think of it as a food, but a supplement that could change the way I feel, think, and operate in the world.
Wow. That was the beginning of you coming on it.
That was the beginning in a lot of ways.
Wow.
Yeah. And from there, continue to talk to the guy, really had trust for him now that he was saying, like, you don't have to take this shit.
Yeah.
Try this. And fully receptive to me wanting to do it naturally, you know, or as natural as possible at that point. The psychologist, I don't know, you know, I just didn't vibe with him.
Yeah.
I'll just say that. I certainly vibed with other therapists in the past, but not with that guy in particular. So it was great because I could gravitate towards this other guy and learn from that.
And you know what's crazy is, like, if you look at it from the hero's journey, you finally accepted the call and you found mentors. But it was in a very interesting situation where you were basically, but yeah, you found mentors. It
wasn't in the way I thought I would.
Yeah.
Right? Which it never is.
Never the way you thought it's going to be. For sure.
Right? And so from there, getting clear on what am I still passionate about? What do I want to do? I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I know I didn't want to lose that aspect of being an athlete.
Yeah.
I didn't want to lose the camaraderie, having teammates, going through things with people you fucking care about when you push yourself to those upper limits of what's physically possible.
And that comes back to your core story. It's about the community. It's not about the individual.
Mm. Yeah, I needed that. Because working out by myself in like a Globo gym scenario was, I felt like a fucking rat on the wheel.
Yeah.
And so getting back to that through mixed martial arts was huge. And then from there, you know, got my first fight a few months into it, won in under 30 seconds and everything just took off.
Yeah.
Along that path, had a boxing coach who would take me for traditional sweat lodges to the Native American reservation and use traditional plant medicine ceremonies and really showed me a different way on how to use those plants.
Yeah.
A different way with respect, reverence, intention. And that gave me all the building blocks and basis to be able to move on after fighting without the fear that I had when I left football.
Mm.
Like if I look back on those two times in my life, that's the fucking difference. The difference is where my head was at when I ended fighting. I was okay with it. I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know that I'd get into podcasting or that I'd come to On It, but there was a trust in the unknown. And that trust was embedded from the fuck having gone through down the rabbit hole in psychedelics.
Yeah. And right? I think that that's one of the most important things to talk about when you're talking about doing psychedelics in an intentional, respectful way is that it teaches you that you can die, that your ideas can die, that your ego can die, but you don't die. And so, like, clearly, your first God death, which is, you know, your ideal, depression, almost died. When it happened again, way smoother. And I think, in part, because you went through the first one, but also because psychedelics teach you over and over and over again, who you think you are can die, but who you actually are witnesses the death and then watches it be rebuilt, you know? So, the UFC death happened. The death of that idea, of that future. What was the in-between period like and how did you find your way here? And I know that you've told this story before.
Yeah, no, that's okay. You got a new podcast, son. I can retell the story.
Yes, sir.
So let's see. I was still working at a strip club, Sporty's Bikini Bar. Shout out, El Camino and Lawrence in Sunnyvale, California. I worked there for 7 years while I was fighting in the UFC.
Yeah.
And there were, it, you know, you talk about polarity. There was a lot of things there that were hard to be around as I was growing as a person.
For sure.
And then ultimately a lot of gratitude for all the people that came that were a party to that because that put food on the table for myself and my family.
Yeah.
And, you know, I continued to have that job to put food on the table when fighting ended, as I had during fighting. I had to work, you know, till 3:30 a.m. every fucking weekend while fighting in the UFC.
That's so sad.
So I kept that job, and thankfully we had low overhead living in my mom's garage for $500 a month in Northern California. And I continued to do the work with my coach and with plant medicines. I had gotten on the Joe Rogan Experience probably 3 years ago. And, you know, he tells a lot of people, like, dude, you should fucking have a podcast. And I hadn't really thought of it. I thought about it, but it wasn't like, okay, maybe I should do this. And then that he was like giving me permission, like, no, yeah, you got to fucking do it. And it's funny because I had an experience on the beach in Santa Cruz with mushrooms. And I was asking about what am I going to talk about on the podcast.
With Joe?
No. Just in general. Like if I'm, this is post-Joe, right? And the thing that fucking came through ringing so loud was, what the fuck do you know? And it was like, God, what the fuck do I know?
Yeah.
What can I share with people? I don't know shit. And it was said in a way that was aggressive, and it was said in a way that made me not want a podcast. And it was like, fuck, and it made me question everything. And that planted a little seed to know more. That planted a little seed to experience more and to share, right? Because nobody's got it all figured out, right? So then that was the permission, and I don't know anything.
Right.
To,
it's almost like
know something, and it, just admitting to that, I have some ground of which I can build upon.
Right. It's that was the wisdom of exactly what type of podcast to do, where you're a student on the and that's exactly what the fuck you do on most of the podcasts, is you're interviewing someone who is an expert and you're learning in real time live with them. It's like, that's the key. You know, it's weird. In myths, like, the way through is basically if you accept something that at first seems bad. You know, like, the way through the forest is you have to admit that you're part of the snake. You know, like, that's like an ancient idea that was most recently echoed in Harry Potter. But it, at what first felt like poison, which, oh my God, I don't know anything, I shouldn't have a podcast, was, oh, that's how I have a podcast. Is I share that I don't know anything and I learn on each podcast with the people that I talk to.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was cool. I think ayahuasca from there really cemented home starting the actual podcast. And it was funny because I didn't know how it would work, but I made a simple prayer that I'd be connected to the right people that can help facilitate that. And I was. I got hit up by the CEO of a company that ran Binaural Beats. And he said they wanted to start a podcast. They wanted to pay me full time to host it. And, you know, ended up, because I was talking about plant medicines, they wanted some differentiation there. So they let it just be my own podcast and they sponsored it full time.
What was it called?
Current Space, Kyle Kingsbury.
I've never heard about that.
Most people hadn't.
Heard?
Dick. And, you know, but it was a great place to start. And what's cool is that, you know, having been on Rogan's and met a lot of these people over the years through, you know, online and talking with people and reading their books, I already had like a fairly good group of people to interview in a podcast with, to learn from, guys like Rob Wolf, you know, I mean, just high level people that were bucket list interviews that I got to have with really no show and no following at all.
How'd you get those guests? Because you knew them in the real world or what?
No, because I mean, there was some, I think, level of street cred from fighting and then also having gone on Joe's show and had a big response from that.
Yeah.
So people, you know, generally, I think if you're alumnus of any club, it's like, oh, hey, brother. Yeah, we've both been on that show.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know what the fuck it was, but they all said yes.
Yeah.
And in them saying yes to me, that gave me permission to continue. And I had this, again, ayahuasca. It came up for me. Money was very tight, but I wanted to travel to meet people. And I really felt called to go to PaleoFX.
Yeah.
And I didn't know why. And I even asked in this ceremony, it was a 3-night ceremony in Vegas. I asked, why do I need to go to PaleoFX if I already know what the fuck everyone's going to say? I've already read their books through and through. There's no 20-minute lecture they're going to give that they didn't spend 3 years writing about in their book.
Yeah.
I'm not going to learn anything new from that. And the answer was, you're not going to learn anything new. You're going to meet people. And you need to meet people. And so the next day, knowing I'm going to go, I get a call from Mind Pump. They tell me, hey, dude, we want you to go. You can be dude on the couch. We've got these dope Airbnbs. You can sleep at all of our places. They ended up paying for my fucking food the whole trip too.
Wow.
And all I had to do was get the flight. Flights dropped $150 round trip. That fucking same day. And I was there. And in that trip, you know, was able to meet a lot of people. I met Tate Fletcher for the first time. I met Aubrey Marcus for the first time. And we got to hit it off at a dinner, but not to the level we would on a flight going home. So on this flight after PaleoFX, we're both heading back to Vegas, where they're going to open up their next Onnit gym. And he sees me getting on the plane and he's like, yo, you flying to Vegas? And I'm like, yeah, that's where I live now. And he's like, cool, I'll save you a seat. So him and John Wolf, the master trainer here at Onnit, I get to sit next to those two guys and we just trade war stories the entire flight back on health and wellness, diet, nutrition, psychedelics, all the fucking trip reports from ayahuasca and everything we've learned. And, you know, Aubrey looked at me and he's like, I got a fucking position for you at Onnit. And I kind of laughed because I was like, look, I got a great thing going in Vegas, but sure, man, I'll come out and check it out. And as I was getting ready, this is cutting through a lot of shit, but as I was getting ready to fly out for the interview, I got fired with no severance in the airport as I was about to board the flight to Austin for the interview with Aubrey.
That is some shit that if you wrote it in a movie, people would be like, that's not realistic. That's too perfect.
Now, the best part of that is that I used their Binaural Beats technology to meditate the entire flight and felt better. This is the irony of it. felt better getting off the plane than before I had heard the news, because I was fucking way more calm, way more trust and faith in how things would develop. And of course, hit it off with Aubrey. I thought we were going to do psychedelics, and that's something we had talked about on the phone. And I think he realized, let me see where this dude's shadow is first is more important, because everybody can look good in the light for psychedelics. Sure. And so we went out and we got bombed on tequila and some other substances. And, you know, he saw that I was all love. And from there, it was, you know, that's really what our relationship has been built on. But it was like, it was a no-brainer. He's like, all right, man, these are all the things I want you to do. And that impressed the fuck out of me, because he saw more in me than I saw in myself. And it blew me away about what I'd be able to do when I got here. And I was like, yeah, man, I'm in. And he's like, well, when can you start? And I just started laughing. Funny you asked that question. This just happened. And he was like, fuck, dude, I had no idea. No one had an idea. How would you know?
Yeah.
You didn't show it, you know? And it's not that that wasn't going on inside, but there was a level of calm in the storm there.
Yeah.
That I had mastered just for that moment. It's not something I have all the time, but I had mastered it for that moment. Because there was an ultimate sense of, I don't know what the fuck's going to happen. We didn't have money to rent a U-Haul to move back into my mom's garage at that point. Everything had been reinvested into the podcast. I just got a second car that I could drive for these long distance interviews with Ben Greenfield and different people, 1,000 miles each direction. Needed something reliable. Everything had been reinvested into that. And, you know, in hindsight, as I look through all these things, any message you talk about, and we talk about that first message I got when I was standing on the edge there naked, I can listen now. I pay attention now to that message, whether that's my own intuition connecting me to a higher source or whether that's the actual higher source just fucking speaking through me. It doesn't matter, right? I'm listening now. And in each one of the times where I listen, I'm rewarded greatly for it.
Yeah.
And it's shown that time and time again. And I don't know why I need to go to PaleoFX. I'm going to go to meet people. All right. Yeah. And then I go. And then Yeah. That makes perfect sense now.
you know?
Like everything makes perfect sense now, looking back upon it. And
it seems like the part of who you could be that's been called forth, especially recently, is like you're the rock in the storm. That's a part of your story now. Like I can be the thing that stands in the most chaotic energy and not break, you know?
And that's what's being called of me right now.
Constantly honing that.
Constantly honing that. Yeah.
So now that you're here, what is the current dream that you have that is the ideal future that you want to make manifest? What's your kingdom of heaven if we're going to use that type of language?
Yeah. So there are two parts to the dream. One, there is the dream of these are the things I want for myself, for my family as goals. I want to have a sense of security. You can talk about Maslow's hierarchy and things of that nature.
We have a meat suit.
Right? I want to have a fucking house that's ours, that we can grow into, that my family can share with others. And I want to grow my family. I'm not sure how that looks right now.
Heard.
Right? I'm not sure how that looks right now, and that's okay. And then also, you know, outside of those things, just knowing that whatever the dream is in continuing the growth, continuing the learning, it's not to try to plan that out for me at this point. I've learned enough to know it's in the state of allowing what's to come.
Yeah.
And to not resist that. And if I can do that sooner than later, then I'll enjoy it longer along the ride.
For sure.
And so that's really been the mission now, is not trying to figure out when on it's going to sell, when all this shit's going to happen, when I'll have a home, when fill in the blank. I don't need to know any of that shit. And that's part of the message I got in Peru with you, was all that I seek, I already have. It's already fucking here. I'm just not seeing it in the timeline that I want it to, right? I want it to be right now. But if I see it through to the end of this picture, it all happens.
The story, yeah.
It all fucking happens. I get it all. it all fucking goes down. And it doesn't happen in the way I want it to or the way I suspect it.
Or when you want it to.
Yeah. But it happens beautifully. And that's part of the fucking awesome mystery that we're in.
Yeah.
Right? It's to not have it all figured out. To let go of that sense of need for control and the need to know. Like, I don't need to know.
And this actually brings me to the question that I like to ask at the end of the podcast. And it's that you're at the end of your life. You've lived the life that you've wanted. You know that tomorrow you're going to die, however you want to die. So that could be peacefully in your sleep. It could be in war, right after an orgasm, whatever. It's your last day. Who do you want with you? And how do you spend that last day? And then I'm going to ask a final question after that. But who's with you and how do you spend that last day?
Well, it'd be my family and my tribe. You know, family being the people that I've chosen to connect with on this plane through a very visceral and real level. My son, my daughter, my wife, anybody that's in that nuclear group. And within that, the tribe as well. People that I've formed tight bonds with and learned from, mentors of mine, brothers of mine, Aubrey Marcus, guys like yourself, like people that I grow old with, that I've learned so much from along the way. I want those people by my side.
For sure. And what do you do on your last day? And you have the health that you want. You're capable of doing the things that you want.
I better fucking have the health that I want. I'm out in nature, you know? I'm out in nature. I'm able to gaze upon the great wonder and beauty that is the fucking world we're in. It's gorgeous here. You know, like I love when Aubrey said on Ferris's, if he had one billboard, what would it be? And it's like, welcome to heaven, population, everyone.
Yeah.
We're fucking here, dude. We're here right now.
Yeah.
And to be expressed in that, you know, what greater cathedral than that of nature? Just to fucking be there and to just sink back into that. You know,
absolutely.
Maybe it would be just floating off in the ocean. I don't fucking know. You know, I don't know how it ends, but I would just want to be in nature with the people that I'm closest with. And maybe on a heroic dose of penis and mushrooms.
That's what I was waiting for. And the final question is, what message or idea do you want to leave as your legend or your myth for generations that might hear your story after you're dead? What would you want that story to be?
The story. Well, if I'm going to give like a quote or an idea, I guess an idea that has served me thus far is to never stop your love for learning. Never lose your fascination with life.
Yeah.
Always keep that spark inside. Don't let it die out. Don't let the spark to know more die in school. Don't let it die in your job. Don't let it die in your relationship. Fan the fucking flames. Do whatever you need to do to be creative. Be in nature. See the bigger picture. But fucking always love life and love the learning and the lessons that come with it.
Thank you.
Thank you, brother.
The myth that make us, y'all. Love y'all. If you want to support the podcast, the most direct way that you can do that is go on iTunes and leave us some love, give us some stars, leave some comments, and share it if you like it. You know, social media is a powerful tool. And if you think that the messages on these podcasts can help people, share them out. Anyways, I love you guys. I appreciate y'all. Namasteezy.